I set a timeline in the back of my head, and in the front of my head, I just gravitated to whatever was interesting and made sense in the moment. You know, when you're evaluating what to do next or you're trying to figure out a new business idea, I think you should spend probably less than 30 hours a week working. And the other, you know, add another 20 or 30 hours doing walks, going, you know, enjoying time with friends, having good long discussions and late nights or whatever, you know, having different experiences that spark creative energy. And creative energy doesn't come from sitting in front of a computer all day. Like, it just doesn't work that way. Now, you could be sitting in front of a computer playing video games or something. That's a different type of thing. But I'm saying sitting in front of a computer, like working, writing
documents. Just
doing
normal work.
Trying to,
yeah,
overanalyzing things. So I'd say, like, work half as much as you normally do and think twice as more than you normally do.
Welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi. Today's guest is Gagan Biyani. He's the co-founder and former president of Udemy, a huge success story in the world of online education. Udemy is worth more than $2 billion. He later co-founded Sprig, a food delivery startup, and was the interim head of growth marketing at Lyft. Gagan recently announced a new education startup focused on cohort-based courses. They've already raised $4.3 million from A-list investors like First Round Capital, Naval Ravikant, and Lee. In this conversation, you'll learn all about the high highs and the low lows of building Udemy and Sprig, how he dealt with getting fired by his co-founder, an honest conversation about financial struggles and the unique parental pressure that comes with being the child of immigrants, why cohort-based courses will play a major role in the future of online education, and finally, he shares some perspective gained from the last 2 years of travel where he visited all seven continents. Share your thoughts with me on Twitter. I'm at BZady and he's at Gagan Biyani. And as always, you can watch the full episodes on video on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. Watch out for an upcoming recording of my first ever live podcast with Jack Butcher. It's part two of our epic conversation from October last year. You won't want to miss that one. Now let's get straight into the show. Gagan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bilal. I'm happy to be here.
So, man, look, I've been following your work for some time. And for people who don't know, you were one of the founders of Udemy, which is one of the most popular and successful online education companies in the world. And you've been in the startup world for many years, working on many different things. So we're going to dig into a lot of that today. But before we do that, I'd love to just paint a picture of what you're working on today.
So in 2009, my co-founders and I popularized this idea called video-based course or MOOCs, which are essentially online courses that are kind of like nonfiction books. You buy them and you can use them as references or learn at your own pace on the internet. And today, that's what most people think of when they think of an online course. Fast forward to 2015, and my now co-founder, Wes Kao, was actually working with Seth Godin and wanted to figure out what Seth's next new project was going to be. And she surveyed the online learning landscape and felt like there was an opportunity to build a much more interactive, more MBA style course over the internet. And she invented what we're now calling cohort-based courses, CBCs. I partnered up with Wes since then, and we are building a cohort-based course platform. Which is a place where anyone can go and build an online course that has both a start and an end date and a cohort of students that are like a learning community that you use to that you work with to build and learn the course together. And so when you take a course with a group of people, it increases accountability, it increases retention, and it also just makes the learning experience a lot more enjoyable.
I think just for, as someone who's been following this from afar, I'm definitely not an expert, but I've like taken courses myself, both in the MOOC form where you sign up and you have this moment of inspiration. And you say, I'm going to learn to code or I'm going to learn a language or whatever. And I don't know the exact numbers and you probably do, but like 80 or 90% of people never finish those courses, apparently. and that I think has been, in one way, it was an evolution of education where, you know, there were really inexpensive ways to learn online, and that was incredible. But I think there's been a lot of problems with that model as well, and that's something you guys are trying to address. But I'd love to dig into Udemy a little bit more, because It's actually an incredible story. And it's kind of like an underdog story where you guys got rejected a bunch by, I think, like 100 plus investors said no. Y Combinator rejected you three times, but you've ended up creating something that now I think is worth more than $3 billion. So if it's okay, I'd love to just go into the earlier time starting that company. So could, maybe we start off with meeting your co-founders who were immigrants themselves in the US. Like what, take me back to that moment. Like when was that and what happened?
Yeah, so this was the summer of 2009. So just 1 year after the credit crisis and the mortgage, mortgage default swap crisis, we were both my two co-founders and myself were enrolled in, or actually one of my two co-founders was enrolled in the Founder Institute, which is like a startup incubator that's sort of pre-launch, pre-product. You just can come in as an individual or as a team without an idea even and go through this incubator and meet other people, but also just try to learn how to build a company. And I had two different ideas at that time that I was working on, and both of them I had different teams that I was working with, and they both fell apart for different reasons. And so this is maybe July or August of that summer. The course, the incubator was set to end in September. And the only way to quote unquote graduate from this incubator was if you launched a company, I think within a few months of the final date. And so I was in danger of not, getting through this incubator. It was my only grasp at Silicon Valley at that point in my career. And so the founder of the incubator introduced me to Aaron and Oktay, which were two Turkish immigrants. I'm an Indian immigrant, so we had a lot in common that way. I'm second generation, they're first generation. So there's a lot of similarities. And they were working on this new idea in online learning called Udemy. And I met them over Skype, and this was sort of, like 2009, so very pre-Zoom. Met them over Skype and watched them demo the product that they had built. And honestly, in part luck, because I didn't have that many other options, and in part because I saw the potential in what they were building, I sort of said, hey, I'd love to work with you in any capacity. And so over the next 4 or 5 months, we worked together casually, no titles, no, I didn't know if I was going to be a co-founder or just an employee or whatever. I just wanted to work with them. And by the end of that 4 months, we agreed to become co-founders.
And just to clarify, because you had a job as well, right? You were a consultant. So were you just working for free, I assume? You were kind of like putting in what people call sweat equity in this case?
Yeah, exactly. I was a consultant. I was actually based in Washington, D.C., and they were based in Palo Alto, California. So there was, 6 hours of difference of flight between us. And also, of course, the fact that I had a full-time job. Actually, I also was part-time writing for TechCrunch at the time. So I was not getting paid for either the TechCrunch nor the Udemy work, but I did theoretically have sort of three jobs at the same time. And I would fly back and forth every sort of Sunday night. I flew to, my client site, which was actually in Roanoke, Virginia. And then on Thursday evenings, I'd fly from Roanoke back to San Francisco. And of course, this is not a direct flight. So I was landing in Chicago in the dead of winter, because this sort of went on all the way through that winter. Landing in Chicago, getting off on the tarmac, changing clothes in the airport bathroom, the whole nine yards, and then switching, so 4.5 hours back to San Francisco, and then going to work with Aaron and Oktay, and trying to crank out some Mobile Crunch articles along the way. So it was a pretty intense time period.
That's pretty mad, man. And you were like early 20s, right? So you could probably had the energy then, but I assume you just weren't really sleeping much, which is not something I want to glamorize because I don't think it's a good thing. But I'm just curious, like, how was your health and mental well-being at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I was 21 years old. I'd graduated a year early, so I was pretty young. And I wasn't sleeping much. That's just the reality. I mean, I probably slept 4 hours a night. And I was lucky in that I had already trained myself to do this back in high school when I had also, you know, had way too many things on my plate. And in order to do that, I sacrificed sleep. And I agree with you. I don't think I would glamorize it at all. In fact, I think that it is a it is the cost of not having an upbringing or the opportunity or just not having been smart enough to take advantage of the opportunities until that point to have had the luxury to have, you know, either capital or frankly, just like, mostly it's capital to be able to afford to just do one thing. And so, yeah, I had to do multiple things at the same time. But, you know, my life was still a lot better than most people in the world. So I can't complain too much.
Well, I've heard you talk about the kind of immigrant hustle that brought you guys together. And I think I've heard you mention you were brought up mainly by a single mother. And she probably was in the same boat working extremely hard to provide for you. Your co-founders came from Turkey and they had visas too, right? So they were working during the day as well. And then they did this in the nighttime.
Yeah, I mean, technically, they're not allowed to be working outside of it. And theoretically, I don't think we were in a lot of ways. So I don't totally know the legality here. But I will say that, yeah, they had H-1B visas and we eventually transferred them over to Udemy. And we had a lot of trouble, actually, transferring those visas over, especially Oktay's, because he did not get a computer science degree. He self-taught himself computer science, and the government doesn't, recognize self-taught people equally to, people who have a formal degree. And so it was actually really a challenge, and I've definitely donated and put some effort into immigration reform since then because of this, because it's such a stupid, honestly, challenge for people immigrating to the United States that we don't do a good enough job of understanding who's talented and sort of who we want, even whether you're on no matter what side of the aisle, we don't do a good job of defining who we want in this country and making sure that we let them in.
Funnily enough, 10 years later, what you're building now is, again, the evolution of being able to recognize people that if they have the will and the want to learn something, that they're going to have a place to go and do that. And we'll get on to some of the credential stuff a little bit later. But I think that's a big problem, because especially in an area like this where things are changing so quickly, right? Like even like what I do, I'm not even a coder, but I've learned marketing and economics and stuff at school. But like if you try to teach that at university, like digital marketing, for example, like whatever you teach a year ago is already obsolete, you know, because things have moved on so quickly. So, I guess we'll dive into that a little bit more later. But thanks for sharing that. Let's talk a little bit about this 1 month deadline that you had. So it sounds like you were working on it on the side or, you know, in the evenings anyway, till early in the morning. And then you guys got to the point where you were getting rejected by every VC in the Valley, basically, or wherever you were pitching. And you kind of set yourself this 1 month deadline. So take me back to that moment with those guys having that conversation and saying, okay, we need to set a time limit here because we can't afford to keep doing this.
So I met Aaron and Oktay in August 2009. And about 7 months later or so in February, I quit my job. So I did actually move in with Aaron and Oktay, and they were in part supporting me. And then in part, I was I'd saved a few thousand dollars. And then, of course, I went into credit card debt. And I didn't know this at the time, but Aaron and Oktay were also going into credit card debt, paying for various expenses related to the company. And so we went and pitched investors, and that was my responsibility. And I had quit my job thinking, hey, we have, 30, 40 meetings lined up with potential investors. We're likely to raise a round. And so we should go ahead and I should quit my job because I don't have time to do. I was doing like investor calls literally at the same time that I was on a conference call with my team at Accenture. And that was just, at some point unsustainable. So I made the leap. And unfortunately, within a few weeks, all of our leads dried up. And then, of course, 3 to 6 months went by. We launched the site publicly, started to get some users. And we were at a crossroads where by this point, because we had met a bunch of investors in the meantime, and also even before I quit, you know, we had probably pitched about 150 plus investors. And that's in person. That doesn't include people, you know, who rejected us over email. And so, you know, we had pitched everyone, we thought. And we realized, shoot, if we don't raise a round, we calculated our debt at some point and realized we were about, I don't know, it's tens of thousands of dollars, but low tens of thousands of dollars in debt collectively. And so it was sort of one of these things where we said, oh, well, if this doesn't work out in the next month, we may just want to have to quit, or at least I, Goggin, has to get a job. Mm. And so I went and tried to raise again. And because in part of the traction related to us launching the business, we were lucky enough to get a few people to say yes. And those people were fairly prominent investors. On the same day, basically, or in the same next 2 days, two people said yes independently. One was Russell Fradin, and the other was Keith Raboy. And between those two people, they were well known enough and well respected enough that they were able to, you know, their names and their connections essentially got us the rest of the round. And so we raised $1 million within 3 weeks after those two said yes.
I'd love to just go into that moment a little bit deeper, because we both share a similar background in terms of immigrant families. We're both Pakistani Indian backgrounds, and I'm sure our cultures definitely overlap. So I just know if I was in your position, and most of the people I grew up with were in the same position, and they had a great job at Accenture, their parents had worked so hard to get them to a safe place, and after a year or two you said, okay, mom, family, I'm quitting my job to go and do this thing, what did people say about that, like your family and your close people? Because I think that's actually something a lot of people don't talk about, is the kind of mental struggle that a lot of people go through, but especially knowing, you know, a lot of my close friends who've done this from our background, there's just a certain pressure traditionally that comes from coming from a poorer background or working class background or immigrant background. So I'm curious if that was even present for you.
It was very present. I'll give a few anecdotes and examples. So, first of all, my mom, which is fairly rare for Indian American families, but my parents divorced when I was in my teenage years. And so and we had a number of financial issues as a result of the divorce. And so my mom was supporting me on an associate's degree and just sort of, you know, climbing up the ladder in financial services, trying to make enough money to sort of put me through and me and my brother through college. And so we just didn't have a lot of money, frankly. And we were certainly consistently worried about either losing our childhood home, which was a nice house. And so frankly, we did grow up well. And also we were worried about, you know, and so I started Accenture living from home and sort of helping my mom pay rent. And then when I moved to DC, I think was giving her some money. The point is that there was a great deal of financial pressure. On the flip side, I grew up in the top five of my class in elementary school and in junior high. And when the divorce happened, I moved down, if you will, and started to do worse in school. And in retrospect, that was actually a very good thing. I'm glad I did worse in school because I put time into other things. But at the time, I think I started to feel more like a failure than a success. And so when I got into Berkeley was not a, and I know for many people this would be a surprise, and I'm sorry, it's just the reality of my situation. I was disappointed. I wanted to go to Stanford or Harvard, or actually my dream school at that time was Wharton at UPenn. I knew I wanted to study business, and it was the best business school in the country. And so I viewed that as kind of a failure. And then when I got to Accenture, the same thing felt true. I felt like someone who was capable of working at McKinsey or Bain or BCG, and felt like I was at a company that wasn't as successful. So frankly, I wasn't that thrilled about my position at that time and did not feel stable, even though, of course, in reality, like, if you're someone who can get a job at Accenture at that time, oh, and the financial crisis made things worse. If you're someone who can get a job at Accenture at that time, you're probably very employable. And I realized this in retrospect, but at that time it felt very tenuous. So for me to then go to my mother and say, hey, I'm not happy here. I don't love this job. It's boring and frankly, it was too easy. Not the Accenture strategy work, but the Accenture that I was in 2009, post-collapse, when they started putting me on projects that were not at the same level of challenge that I had signed up for. So I was being put on projects that were in the government where people, frankly, don't work very hard, or at least didn't in the projects that I work in. Not the people, there are plenty of people in the government who work hard, just not the people I was working alongside. So I was bored and upset. I thought that this was a bad job and wasn't happy with it. And so frankly, my mom, I think in some ways just took pity on me and empathized with my situation. And this is like the saving grace of my mother and the way that she raised us is that she gave everything for us. And so that can be a blessing and a curse. But in the context of this, it's a huge blessing because she basically was willing to take on more challenges in her personal financial life in order to make it possible for me to take this risk. And so she did, you know, sort of encourage me not to take the risk in August when I first met Aaron and Octai. And so I waited 6 months. But then eventually I did make the jump. And it was really freaking hard. Like I felt, you know, I had grown up in an environment that was hard enough that I was someone who did not notice when I was feeling trouble. It was all internalized. But in retrospect, I definitely was internally struggling and I was very stressed. And I was probably, you know, a difficult person to be around at that time during my social life. So I also was not doing my best. It's not having my best moments outside of work. I was putting all my energy and effort into work. Lucky for me, I had, you know, a few moments where friends or family sort of stuck up for me and gave me what I needed. And I got through it. Starting companies, this is where the concept of privilege is so important and so misunderstood. I had privilege by almost any definition, probably what I would call top 5% privilege or even top 0.1% privilege if you just take into account the fact that I was born into the San Francisco Bay Area at one of the best public high schools in the country. But of course, from a financials perspective, I wasn't in the top 0.1%, not even in the top 1% probably, but still in the global context, top 5%. Still, because I wasn't in the whatever in the top 1%, top 0.1%, I can compare, right? I could understand what it was like to be better. And then, of course, we came from, you know, my family probably lived on a few dollars a day when we were really, really young, or my grandparents were growing up. And so maybe probably less. And so, like, I saw that as well. And being in this middle spot allowed me to understand this. And the truth is, privilege is just being able to, you know, in this context, I was so privileged that I got the education that I was able to be knowledgeable and smart enough to sort of go about these challenges, like get into a school like Berkeley, afford to go to a school like Berkeley, get into Accenture Strategy, et cetera. But then I also wasn't privileged enough to then afford the next step of having peace of mind while simultaneously taking a big risk like starting a company. And so I think that's where people misunderstand. Privilege is a spectrum. And it's not like the people at the top have privilege and the people at the bottom don't. It's like actually everyone has some level of it. And depending on what your ambitions are, et cetera. And then if you don't have privilege in this context, at least for me, I was like, I had no right to complain about the fact that I didn't have, you know, what most people for some reason in modern culture, at least the culture that I live in now, think is like supposed to be what is reasonable. Their expectation today is that you should be able to start a company without having financial struggles. And it's like, I guess, but at the same time, like, it's not so bad. You know, I never had risk of food, you know, food disappearing off my table. And so, yeah, it was tough. And I definitely faced that. At the same time, I had the perspective to understand that it was not so tough that I viewed or took pity on myself. And instead, I looked at it like, this is tough work that I am taking upon myself. I wanted to start a company. I was unhappy with what was a glorious job by most definitions. And so I took on that pain and I was willing to internalize it. But at the same time, I won't deny that it was really tough. And there were some really, really hard moments there.
I just wanted to bring it up because I don't think I haven't even brought that up with anyone else on the show. So it's something that I've experienced in a different way, and a lot of people I know do. And it's not even just about business. This is all work. It's just in general, when you come from a different culture and you come to a Western culture, there's obviously a clash. And that's sometimes not because someone is trying to be evil or do something wrong. It's just because there's very conflicting ways of seeing the world. And it's a really hard thing to navigate, especially when you add in financial problems. If you have family problems with a divorce as well, that adds a lot of complications to it. So thanks for sharing that, man. I think there's plenty of people who will gain from that. Last question on that. Did you feel guilty leaving at that moment?
I don't know that guilt was the right term. I think I felt responsibility. I felt responsibility for my family. And, you know, when my father sort of, and when my parents divorced, my father sort of disappeared for a while there. You know, I became the quote unquote man of the house, or the person who was emotionally, certainly, and also financially responsible for the family to some extent, although frankly, my mom ran the household, like, let's be clear. But I felt like I was slowly stepping in. I felt like I sped into that role faster than I expected. And so, yeah, I think that I felt, I definitely felt like a lot of pressure on the finances. At the same time, I was so buried in work and trying to solve the problems. It was sort of one of those things where you're like, you know, it's like if you're running a marathon. I've never run a marathon, but I've run, you know, a medium distance. I'm not a good runner, but I'm going to use the analogy anyways. Like, you're running a marathon and you're like, just one more mile, then I'll feel better. And like, so in business, in these situations, you're thinking, well, maybe the next meeting will be the one that's, you know, where the investor says yes. And maybe the next meeting. So as you're in the weeds, you know, that pressure is there in the background and it's constantly taking up cycles, but it's not in the foreground. And so, yeah, I felt pressure.
So just the last question on that. And again, this is coming from a semi-selfish place because I feel like I've had this feeling myself, but if I felt it, I'm sure you might have felt it, and I'm sure lots of people out there felt this too, is when you grow up where you have financial problems and you've been in a household where that's an issue, at that time, you might not even realize it, right? Because sometimes you really know, oh, we can't pay rent this month, or we're in debt or whatever. But a lot of the time, you just know what you know. That's just your family position, right? I've been in the same place. But I've seen it manifest into two different things. Sometimes it drives people to say, I don't want to be poor. I want to be a success, which is a positive manifestation. The other side is it cripples some people and you're just scared forever. Like, even if you're rich, you're scared I'm going to go broke. And I've seen this and I've felt it even myself to a certain extent, because we've had, you know, my parents did an amazing job with us and they did everything they could to provide for us. But there were times every month where we were, you know, basically going to overdraft every single month, and then we would just make it back the next month. And I didn't know that wasn't, you know, I just thought everyone had that, you know, because that's all you know growing up. And even now when I'm fairly comfortable, I still have this feeling in the back of my head, like, I don't want to ever be in that situation. So I'm curious, like, did that happen to you? And do you feel like you went like one of those routes if you experienced that?
I resonate with both sides of those, of that. On the one hand, I would say my motivation was always to be successful, but not always to make money. So money has always been secondary for me. And I think what happened for me growing up is that I, instead of creating a healthy sort of, you know, motivation towards money, I had a healthy disdain for money, I would call it. So I had a healthy disdain and a healthy respect for money. My disdain was that I didn't like how it controlled our lives. And so I was determined not to allow money to control my own life. And so whether that's my ambition or whether that's like my day-to-day happiness, I've done a very good job of separating how much money I have from how free I live my life and how much my money, you know, sort of affects my motivation for doing things. On the flip side, I had a healthy respect for money in that I didn't waste it or spend it on needless things, you know, until just last year, or I guess September of this year, really. I had never paid over $1,000 a month in rent. And, you know, and I lived in expensive places like Palo Alto and San Francisco over that time period.
Last month, you said, or like this year?
September. Yeah.
That's the first time you paid more than $1,000 in rent and you lived in San Francisco.
Yeah. To define this more clearly, I left San Francisco 2017. After that, I certainly had months where I paid more than $1,000 because I was traveling internationally. And so I would get an Airbnb for, you know, whatever, $2,000 or $1,500 for a month. So that definitely happened. But I never signed a lease or committed myself to a long-term engagement that was over $1,000 a month until September, where I signed a six-month lease here in Austin.
And just wait, so that's pretty, one, for people who don't know the rental prices in those markets, like they're expensive markets, right? So like how, was that just because you were sharing with people or you found really good deals? Like, and that was obviously a conscious decision, right? Because you wanted to keep your burn rate low.
It's really just about learning to be happy and live and be comfortable and productive with whatever is financially feasible for you, and not to want or need greater levels of comfort prior to greater, above greater levels of freedom. So this is the trade-off that people constantly make incorrectly. They think that their short-term or medium-term comfort is better than the short than the long-term freedom that they lose for that comfort. So if you, for example, can afford $2,000 a month, but that means that you have to work for the next 3 years in the same job, then you are tied to that job. And that you are essentially sacrificing your long-term freedom in exchange for, you know, a $2,000 a month studio where you live alone and you have that comfort. And so you've made a trade that you may not, may or may not realize. Now, some people make that trade consciously and are happy with it. Fine. I think the majority of people make that trade without understanding really what the ramifications of that trade are, and without having the fortitude or without learning how to teach yourself to be happy living with roommates, how to teach yourself to be happy living with, you know, a place that's furnished off IKEA furniture or whatever it is, right? Or in a place that's a little bit further outside the city, or whatever compromise you end up having to make, or whatever compromise is right for you. Yeah, I think that I've been taught by my mother really learn to live with less and be happy with that. And now I'm, you know, I spend less than almost anyone I know at the same level of income and net worth. And I'm still ridiculous. I think I'm more happy than most people I know at the same level. And so I think that this is something that you can train yourself to do. And I don't think it's that hard, but you have to be committed to it.
I think you perfectly articulate it, because you shared what you think and you clearly have a passion for this and you've thought a lot about it. But also you said, well, but if you did think about it and you made the trade and that's what you want to do, then great. Because I think sometimes some people will say the first part and just say the whole world needs to do what I'm doing. And I think that's a well-balanced outlook on it. So just to move on, thanks for sharing that, first of all. The next thing on Udemy, just to wrap up there, was, long story short, it's become a huge success, right? The valuation now, I believe, is more than $3 billion or something along those lines. We don't have time to go through every single step of the way there. But at one point, Aaron, one of your co-founders, fired you, you said. I don't know if this is something you've shared much about before. I haven't heard too much about it. But like, what happened in that situation and why did he fire you?
Yeah, so I wrote a tweet thread about this, which is what you're referring to, and it, you know, it happened to get pretty popular on Twitter. So I hope your listeners will go and read it, or just check me out on Twitter. It's a great time to plug it. Basically, when you're starting a company and you're 21 years old, you have no idea what you're doing. At least I didn't. I had no idea what I was doing, and I didn't know how to manage people. I didn't know how to scale a team. And all of a sudden, the company was starting to get some revenue, and we realized we needed to build a team out to continue to grow the revenue of the business. And so I started to build out a team. And about 2 months into building a team, the first two or three people I had, I think we had just great relationship and it worked well. But I realized I realize now that my range wasn't amazing. So I was good with a certain type of person, but maybe there's like out of, let's say there's, you could type all people into nine different categories. Let's just say you do that. That I use the Enneagram as an example of typing. There may be like one or two types that I was really comfortable managing and working with. And then there were seven other types that I was not. And those types were probably even more specific than one out of nine. Maybe it was even one out of 100 or something like that. I don't know. And so I started to have people on the team who had different types of personalities and different skill sets and different ways of communicating. And my range was really poor. And so I had trouble sort of managing and working with different personality types. And Aaron eventually discovered this. And because we were a bit siloed, I was working on my stuff, he was working on his stuff, he got upset about it. Now, the funny thing is, I don't think that I was as quote unquote bad as someone who should have gotten fired at that point. But the complexity of this situation is that I was a fairly important person at the company. And Aaron felt like he also, I think, and I don't know, I mean, you'd have to ask him, but I think he felt like he doesn't know how long it takes for someone to learn how to have more range, or how, whether or not, like, you know, Goggin's going to actually like improve on all of this. And so there was a little bit of like, okay, we, you know, Aaron doesn't know whether or not I'm going to change and whether this is a thing endemic to me or whether this is permanent or not. And then I felt like, you know, this is something I wanted to fix, but I still wanted to retain me. I still wanted to be me and be direct and share my opinions openly. And I personally have a lot of consternation with the modern sort of millennial, you know, and it's been painted as millennial. It's not just millennials. I'm pretty sure I'm a millennial. So like the modern sort of ethos of, you know, I'm a special flower and I need you to communicate with me in a way that works for me. And it's not about your communication style, the manager. It's all about the person who's not in position of power. And so I still to this day don't love that and think that it should be a partnership between both parties. I think that I'm now at a point where I can kind of work with anyone. And so that's the good news. But I didn't love that I didn't, you know, I wanted to learn how to be me and yet still be a great manager. And that process was something that we didn't, you know, Aaron didn't feel like he had time for and essentially said, hey, you know, we want to part ways. And so I left. And, you know, I think that had more repercussions than he may have wanted. And I think I also realized that this took longer for me than I would have expected to learn. And I'm still someone who I think, you know, if you work with me, I'm going to be direct. And sometimes you're going to be like, whoa, that was pretty direct. And what I've realized is this is actually a very cultural thing. I grew up in an Indian household. If I go back to my family in India, everyone talks like how I talked when I was 22 years old talking to my employees. Like everybody talks to you that way. Aaron and I clashed a little bit. I don't think that the clash was as pronounced as it may seem, you know, if you think about firing a co-founder, but it did happen. And so I left the company and I mean, the company today has benefited from me not being there and also has had challenges as a result of that, I think. And that's just, you know, that's just reality. And fortunately, marketplace businesses are so resilient and the people who work at Udemy and who have worked there in the past are so talented and good that they were able to pick up the mantle and continue to do, frankly, in a lot of ways, more amazing things than probably what I would have done if I was still there.
I will point out that it sounds like you two are still friends. And he even I saw him on the cap table or the list of investors that in your new startup. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say we're pretty good friends. I mean, we're better friends than almost any other person I've co-founded a company with, other than the one time I co-founded a company with a best friend. So I would say Aaron and I talk, I don't know, 5 to 10 times a week. We exchange messages and then we get on the phone maybe once a month or something. And we've been in good communication the whole time. That's why, like, I said a few times throughout this explanation, like, it wasn't as intense as it may seem, because I think that I respect Aaron's decision. Like, I get it. Like, it's hard to manage people and being CEO is tough. And you may not want to deal with a culture clash between you and your co-founders. And on the flip side, I think he respects that I probably the one thing he respects more than anything is that I handled it well and wasn't an ass about it, honestly. And I did not talk shit about him. I didn't have shit to talk about him, to be honest. I still think he's amazing. I think he's probably one of the most brilliant founders in the Valley period of our generation. And so, like, I'd put him up there with the founders of really any unicorn company that I know of. I think he's that talented and that good. And so the truth is, I didn't have anything bad to say about him. I was pissed at myself and I was pissed at the situation. And I sort of, you know, I did not love that he did that. I was a little annoyed at him. Don't get me wrong. I was pissed at him for sure for a while, but I didn't externalize that to other people. And so when people asked me, or when I was like, you know, interviewing at Lyft, or when I started my next company and people asked me what happened or whatever, I was relatively, I was thoughtful and balanced about it, telling the truth. So I wasn't hiding everything, which I think would also be bad and making it sound like it was all rainbows and sunshine. But also I was not mean or mean-spirited about it. And I think that is probably one of the best things I've ever done is just every time I've left a relationship or a company or anything, I've always tried to leave it in a good place, even if there were challenges along the way. And that's the real lesson for me with Udemy, is that I have had a lot of benefits because of the fact that Aaron and I have maintained, not just maintained a friendship, but actually our friendship has flourished over the last, you know, 3 to 5 years.
The kind of nuanced story of it is it's not just all good or all bad. There's definitely a bit of both. And just the last question on that, do you still have any involvement with the company? Do you have ownership still, or like, I'm just curious how that worked out in the end.
I still have what I would consider for myself significant stock in the company, but what the company would consider insignificant stock, in the sense that I don't have enough stock to make any sort of voting decisions or anything like that. I have a very small amount relative to the total shares. And I've sold some along the way enough to, you know, give myself some financial stability. Yeah, I mean, so I have no involvement in the company other than we are inextricably linked. The company can never divorce itself from my title as co-founder. And I can never divorce myself from having been the co-founder of a company that today I don't get to make decisions in. And so whatever they do reflects on me, and whatever I do reflects on them. And so I think we've done a pretty good job of building a relationship, particularly because of how public I am at times. You know, building a relationship where, you know, if I make a mistake, like I recently shared numbers that I wasn't supposed to. And, you know, the head of PR sent me an email and said, hey, you know, you got these numbers wrong. And I was like, I said, sorry. And I immediately fixed it. And she, you know, I don't think she has any ill will towards me. She knows this happens. And she feels comfortable sending me an email about it. I think that's great. We have a good relationship to the extent, but I'm not involved in the day-to-day decisions of the company, or even even in the month-to-month or year-to-year decisions of the company.
You know, there's so many lessons from that time. So I appreciate you sharing that. We're going to move on really quickly to Sprig, which was your next company. We're not going to go through the full story of Sprig for the sake of time, but I do want to touch on it briefly, because I think it lays the foundation for what you're now doing. So just the high level of Sprig from the outside was it was a meal delivery app or a meal delivery service for it looked like healthy food or something like that, right?
Yeah, Sprig was an online restaurant. You could open your phone, tap 3 buttons, and within 15 minutes, we'd serve you a healthy, hot, delicious meal delivered to your doorstep for $15. It eventually became closer to 22 minutes and $18 to $20, but that was sort of the promise.
The reason I want to bring this up is because I've heard you say you learned more from these 4 years at Sprig, and you had a great experience overall, except for, you know, maybe it didn't turn out the way you want it to turn out, but the learning process through that was really amazing for you. And it was also a chance for you to kind of, you know, after having a success partly at Udemy and then moving on to your next thing, it probably gave you the ownership to say, like, this is my next thing. I'm going to like prove myself. I'm going to create something of value. And it didn't work out. And that happens, right? So, but there were lots of really positive things that came out of it. I've heard you say that it failed for 3 reasons. One is because you mistook the present for the future. The second was that your profit equation was off. and a third that was because of the cap table and burnout. I think there's three lessons in there for people, because that this is very common for a lot of people, especially businesses like that. I want to talk about a moment you've described, Shamav, the famous investor from Social Capital. He tells you that the business was going to fail. And he said, this is going to fail, right? And I'm just curious because, you know, I'm a big fan of his. I think he's a really well-respected guy. But obviously, he's a human. He could be wrong as well. So, like, take me back to that moment of him saying that to you. And, like, how did you take that?
This was summer of 2016. And our growth had gone up to about $22 million in run rate at our peak in February of that year. And by this time, we had already lost about 20 or 30% of our business. And that's not a great thing at a company that stage to lose revenue, even though we and there was a lot of complexity because we didn't know if maybe it was seasonality. Maybe people over the summer were ordering food less, which is obviously somewhat true, but we didn't know how much it was affecting us. The challenges were mounting, and we were starting to realize, like, hey, there's a serious problem here. And Chamath, we went into a meeting with the Social Capital team, and Chamath sort of shared with us his concerns and felt like the business was did not have good fundamentals. You know, we went back to our board. Chamath was not on our board, for what it's worth. We had a different group of people, and another Ted from Social Capital and Simon from Greylock, and went back to our board. And over the next few months or a year, basically, we kept deciding, like, over and over again, to resuscitate the company with different efforts. And, you know, ultimately we failed. We couldn't resuscitate the company. And actually, the process of doing so cost us a lot of money. So we spent a lot of money over that next year. Even though we did, like, three layoffs and tried to save costs as much as possible, it didn't matter. We still just spent a lot of money over the next year. So we had burned through a bunch of capital that we could have returned theoretically if we had listened to Chamath and agreed with him. And then the other thing that happens is that as if you make incremental changes as your business is, if your business is fundamentally broken at the bottom and you make incremental changes that are increasing in how deep they go, the change we made was always one step behind the change we needed to make. And so we'd make a change, and let's say, like, we're at layer four. Let's say we have a hierarchy, a pyramid of how deep you are. So level four and level one is the deepest level. It's like whether you're in the food business or not. Level four is you're in the food business. You're serving meals that are healthy, that are fast and cheap. So this is a specific value proposition, and there's layers in between. So we would always go one layer deeper, one layer less deep than we needed to go to make the changes that we needed to make. And that meant that we were essentially chasing our own tail for a year. And it was really, really tough. We laid off, whatever. At our peak, we had 1,300 people on payroll for a month. And that includes a lot of part-time employees. About 1,000 or 1,200 probably were part-time or hourly. And then 60 or so in the headquarters full-time and, whatever. So there were different constituents. And we laid off people slowly over time over the course of a year. And eventually we shut the business down. That was probably the toughest... That was the toughest year of my adult life, I would say. Much tougher than getting fired from Udemy, which was the toughest year of my adult life prior to that.
Again, I think you have shared a great thread on this on Twitter, which we'll again link to. But just hearing it from your own voice is a little bit different, right? Like, there's an emotion to it. There's a tone to it. And it's a tough thing. But it's something that, a lot of people... wish they could even get to that point where they've raised this money from the best investors in the valley. They've actually got something that's working to a certain extent. It sounds like there were so many factors that impacted it, but one of them being, I think, Uber Eats came into the market and that started affecting the dynamic of the marketplace. One quote that I want to share here is something I remind myself of all the time, is that you're never as good as everyone tells you when you win, and you're never as bad as when they say when you lose. And what I love about that quote is because, like, if you just rewind a few years when you're the president or CEO of Udemy, the company's doing well, at that moment, everyone's in your ear saying, oh, well done. Like, oh, you're doing so well. And I'm sure, I think you even said your dating life had improved or something like that. Or maybe that was the next time around. There's all these, you know, there's an overconfidence that comes from that. And then on the flip side, when things don't go well, you're normally not as bad as they say either. So whether that was getting fired or the company not working out. But it's easy to say that in hindsight. At the time, it doesn't ever feel like that. So it sounds like at that moment, you decided to take some time out, which is where that leads us to you going for a 3-year break, essentially. Well, you also went to Lyft. I don't know if Lyft was in between Sprig or was that before?
Before Sprig and after Udemy.
Okay, cool.
Just a quick fact check. I was president at Udemy. Aaron was CEO. And then at Sprig, I was CEO, and that's where, you know, I saw the real benefits of being a successful Valley founder. At Udemy, we never really got credit for our success until way later.
And that's what's interesting, because like you said, Udemy has gone on and is still, you laid the foundation for something that is still a success today. And Sprig at the time maybe was going to become a success if it went down another route or the market wasn't in a certain way. But yeah, I'm curious, like, that's probably quite hard to deal with. Like, did the way people behave with you change? Like, did you notice like who your real friends were? Like, were there moments like that that stand out to you?
I'm very lucky, and anyone who works in Silicon Valley is very lucky, that we stand on the shoulder of giants. And it just so happens that there have been plenty of people who have failed and then come back to be successful. That there was very little social pressure or anxiety or disappointment in Sprig when it did eventually announce its shutdown. So fortunately, that never happened. The cognitive dissonance of being successful or being perceived as successful when we were actually failing and having a lot of trouble was very difficult. And it created serious stress for me. I had to do a lot of personal things to try and manage that and didn't even that successfully manage it. And so we did a very good job of hiding that we were failing until we eventually just shut down the business. And that, at least hiding it from the public eye, I'm sure people in closed doors knew what was going on or behind closed doors. So I would say, yeah, it was obviously tough to essentially go out there and people congratulating you and sort of treating you like you have done something amazing. And for you to know that it's really not amazing right now. And it felt very existential within the company. And so we knew it was very possible that it was not going to work out. And living a lie for me was very difficult. Sprig was way better at raising money and creating buzz than it was actually a good company. And so if you assume that that buzz is because of the assumption that people have that it's a great company, I didn't deserve it. Right? It wasn't as successful as people perceived. And so, yes, was it a good shot? Do I feel proud of the work we did? Definitely. And do I think we deserve some credit? Certainly. But as you said at the outset, and I think the quote you made, you recited was perfect. It was not as bad as it seems when we shut down, and it was never as good as it seemed when we were successful. And that's true even of Udemy, and any other success or failure in my life to date. I think that statement is very, very, very real.
Well, thanks for sharing that, man. I think that's a great thing to segue us into kind of more recent times. So you've now just spent the last 3 years, you were traveling, you went to all 7 continents around the world, you were living in places for 1 month at a time and above. So I'd love to go into a bit of your experience there. But for context for people listening, it sounds like it was 3 years of you being able to be a bit of a nomad, but the last year you were quite intentional about trying to figure out what you're going to do next. Whereas the first 2 years sounds like it was just more like a turn everything off. No meetings, no calls, no podcasts, nothing like that. Let me just go enjoy myself and explore the world. Is that an accurate understanding of what the 3 years were broken down into?
Yeah, that's about right. I spent, you know, almost 2 years just traveling like a nomad and exploring the world and meeting people all over the world. And then I took a year my girlfriend went to Oxford Business School. And so while she was, you know, doing Oxford, I sort of decided I was going to take that 12-month period because it's a 1-year program to evaluate what I wanted to do so that we would sort of move into the next phase of our lives at the same time.
So just to call out a few places, I saw you mention you went to Havana, Medellin, Mumbai, Shanghai, Seoul, Berlin, Kigali, Beirut, the Amazon rainforest, and even Antarctica. So it's a pretty crazy trip. What was your expectation going into it versus what it actually ended up being like, the full trip as a whole?
Well, I didn't know how long it was going to be or where I was going to go when I started. And so I didn't really have expectations going in and just sort of was living in the moment. And to some extent, just wanted a break from, I grew up in the Bay Area. I'd lived there my entire life, you know, except for a year in Washington, D.C. And so I just wanted to take time away from everything, basically. And really it wasn't just about going away from the valley, but also towards learning more about the world. So I didn't really have a lot of expectations going into it. I will say that I got out of it way more than I think people may expect from a period of time like that. I was very fortunate in that it was my, you know, third solo trip like that, maybe fourth or fifth, actually. It was probably, you know, the first country, Cuba, that I went to was probably my 40th or 50th country that I had visited. I don't keep track of these things well, but so I was already an experienced traveler, and it allowed me to go deeper during this time. And it was super magical. I mean, it was magical. That's the best way to describe it. I don't have a desire to go and do that, you know, go travel like that right now. I'm quite happy with building this business and making a difference in the world in that way. But that year and a half to 2 years of traveling was really special.
I mean, I've been to Cuba too, and it's the people I found were incredible. Just like my experience anyway, people were the most friendly people I've met in most places. And I think you did something similar where you live with someone like a local, right?
Most people live in what's called a casa particular. Yeah. Which is basically you live in a room in someone's house. And so that's what I did. One of the rooms I stayed in, I couldn't really stand up in it. So it wasn't very tall, and it had three single beds in it. And so I just slept in one of those single beds and put my clothes on the other. And that's sort of the room I was in. And I'd have to walk down the stairs to go to the bathroom or shower or something. And I lived with this family that, you know, I ate meals with them. And then I got to know other people in the area in Havana. And it was a really what made the experience so special was that I was able to experience daily life to some extent in Havana because of the sort of length of time. So when you visit a place for 4 days, everything's new, you're visiting new things, you're having experiences. When you visit it for 2 weeks, you start to settle in a little bit, you start to get to know people. When you're there for a month, and even 3 months or 6 months or 2 years, you know, your experience changes dramatically, and you can't compare a 1 week experience to a 1 month experience or a 1 month experience to 2 years experience. So in a month is really what I decided to do in most of the cities you named. By spending a month, I was able to go deep and meet friends and make long-term relationships, people who I still communicate with to this day.
Just for a mini quick fire round, I'm just going to ask you, for some of your some places that you traveled to, and just tell me what you think. So is there a place that surprised you the most?
Havana.
Oh yeah, okay.
Havana surprised me the most. That's easy.
What about a hidden gem? Is it also going to be Havana?
No. Beirut or Kigali, they're both hidden gems for different reasons.
So tell me more about Beirut, because I think a lot of people in the States, at least, don't know enough about Beirut, and it's in Lebanon. So like I think the perception of Lebanon here is very different to what it actually is.
Yeah, Beirut is known as the Paris of the Middle East. Not sure the description is perfect, but it has a lively nightlife, great dining. The people are extremely warm. It is sort of I would call it like second world, and I use a four part system developed by Hans Rosling. But you know, they're in the second phase of they're just below the United States or they're in the same realm as China or maybe parts of India in terms of how developed it is. And the people are extremely warm. I mean, you know, the perception we have of, call it Arabic or Muslim or whatever category you want to use, Middle Eastern people, especially not Middle Easterns in the Western world, which we're quite accustomed to, but Middle Eastern people from that region itself, you know, growing up, it was pretty negative. I didn't have that because I, you know, was smart enough not to listen to the media on this, but we have a fairly negative view. And, you know, Beirut's a very liberal, open place. There's three different religions that live very, cohesively there.
So we're going to switch gears a little bit to the last part of the last 12 months where you were starting to figure out your next step. And I know you shared previously that you were starting to teach some courses. I know you did one with Sam Parr with The Hustle on ideation or something along those lines. You'd started to write. You even started writing like a memoir or something like that. And you were trying to figure out what you're going to do next. And now you've landed into this place where you've actually you've already started a new company since September. So just take me into your mind a little bit around like how you've thought about that, because it sounds like it isn't just like, oh, I'm going to sit down and answer these questions and I'm going to figure out what I'm going to do for the next year. It felt like you were just trying to feel things out and have a sense for what's calling your name almost. But I don't know, what was that like for you, that process?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because this was not a straightforward process by any means. And of course, I knew I was intentional about the fact that I was doing a process. So I when I met my girlfriend during these travels, sort of towards the end, just before going to Beirut, I sort of started to realize that I was tired of traveling and wanted to find a place that was home and sort of start to build something for the future. And I realized that if I was going to do that, I needed to give myself enough time to make a really important and intentional decision, because if I was right about what I did next, I would spend 10 years on it. So I was exchanging emails with someone who I've been lucky enough to exchange emails with, although we're not like close or anything, but I was exchanging emails with Naval Ravikant, who's been invested in all three of my companies. And I asked him like, hey, I'm going to start spending some time thinking about what's next. What advice do you have for me? And he said, take 12 months, a minimum. So it wasn't 12 months maximum, it was 12 months minimum. That's important to remember. And so it just, you know, the timeline worked out, and I said, okay, I'm going to take 12 months. I'm not going to make a decision until the end of the 12 months. And other than that, there was no other process. There was nothing written down. There was no like goals of what I was going to do. I just knew that I was going to take 12 months. And by the end of 12 months, I was going to come up with what I wanted to do next, or I was going to hope I did. And so I started to explore various potential futures. And I started to think about writing a book. And I went through the process with Tucker Max's Scribe Writing, which is a company, Scribe Media. And I went through the process of writing a book, a memoir about my travels. And I realized I didn't want to become a writer. And then I realized that I was so rusty, that everything I was doing was incredibly slow. I was slow at taking meetings. I was slow at being in meetings. I was saying all sorts of stupid things and realizing that I was still getting my sea legs underneath me. And so I started to naturally teach online courses in order to get myself practice towards building a business again. And of course, so I started teaching online courses because that was the easiest thing to make money at the time. I thought, oh, I'll start teaching people how to do growth marketing. I know growth marketing. I'll teach people some that. And then I thought, oh, I'm starting to ideate on a business. Let me teach ideation to a group of students. And so I basically started teaching courses as a way to both earn some revenue, not because I needed the money, although the money was nice, but more because I wanted to practice doing business again. And simultaneously, I was taking courses like Tucker Max's course on building a book. And then I took a course by David Perel on writing called Rite of Passage. And so as I was taking and teaching courses, I realized, wow, I naturally was gravitating to these online courses. And these online courses are completely different from what a Udemy course was, right? Like I was not taking, I did actually take a masterclass at one point, but I wasn't taking these video-based courses really, Coursera, Udacity, Masterclass, Udemy. I wasn't doing that. I was doing a new form of course that was done entirely over Zoom, that was live and interactive and had a community element. And That's what I was doing. And so if you want to structure this process, the structure here is that I was just doing whatever was interesting or enjoyable for myself. And in the back of my mind, I had the goal of 12 months. But in the forefront of my mind, I was just, okay, what am I going to do for the next month or two? And I was just picking up projects, dropping projects, etc.
And you'd see which what your interests were taking you towards, right? I do like this approach because you, if you're able to take the time, obviously not everyone can do that. But so you've got like a time limit. That's something which I think is quite key, because if you don't have the time limit, or what, yours wasn't a limit, it was a minimum. But I personally think it's good to have some sort of limit as well, because otherwise someone like me, will, you could just keep feeling like that for 5 years and you're like stuck in something. You're not really finding the next thing. But then you're not forcing it on the other side to say, I need to find this thing right now. You're just kind of saying, well, what am I interested in? It gives you the room and space to go and explore. And then through that, you've now landed onto something and you've seen an opportunity, right?
I set a timeline in the back of my head. Mm. And in the front of my head, I just gravitated to whatever was interesting and made sense in the moment. And so by doing so and constantly and having plenty of time, you know, when you're evaluating what to do next or you're trying to figure out a new business idea, I think you should spend probably less than 30 hours a week working. And the other, you know, add another 20 or 30 hours doing walks, going, you know, enjoying time with friends, having good long discussions and late nights or whatever, you know, having different experiences that spark creative energy. And creative energy doesn't come from sitting in front of a computer all day. Like, it just doesn't work that way. Now, you could be sitting in front of a computer playing video games or something. That's a different type of thing. But I'm saying sitting in front of a computer, like working, writing
documents.
Just
doing normal work.
Trying to,
yeah.
Overanalyzing things. So I'd say like work half as much as you normally do and think twice as more than you normally do.
I think a key thing there is really giving yourself the mental space, because anything you're trying to force, you know, a lot of the time it doesn't work like that. And it's another quote that I love, that someone, which kind of relates to this, which I've shared recently, is the stay hungry, not thirsty. And the difference being, hungry means you're like open to like finding something, you're like, you've still got some passion for what you're doing. But thirsty is when you're really like desperate. You're like, what am I doing next? Oh, I need to find the next thing. I need to make money right now. And that's a hard balance to find a lot of the time. So thanks for sharing that. So let's, for the last part of the show, we're going to talk about what you're working on with the new cohort-based courses company. You haven't got a name for the company yet, so it's still early stages. But you've raised a bunch of money already from some of the best investors around, first rounder involved, from the angel side and operators, people like Naval, who you mentioned, Austin, the founder of Lambda, Rahul Vora, Sahil, a bunch of people like that. And then I also love that you've got this segment of knowledge influencers, which is, I thought, was really smart, especially given what you're doing. People like David Perel, Jack Butcher, who was on the show, Pomp and Chan were also on the show as well. Incredible list of people that you've convinced to be a part of this. You've raised over $4 million for it. So let's go into the kind of like the thesis of what you're working on and the opportunity you're seeing, because you've gone through the process of going through these courses yourself. And you founded one of the pioneers in this space previously. So what is the evolution that you're seeing, and how do these cohort-based courses fit into that evolution of education?
When I was, I think of ideation as the process of, because I mostly work on consumer-facing businesses, is the process of like being a normal human as much as possible and watching opportunities as a normal human, rather than looking at it from a market standpoint, or doing, you know, research on a bunch of companies or anything. So I, as a normal human, over the 12 months prior to starting this company, started to take and deliver online courses in this new format. And through that process, I noticed a pattern, which is that there is actually a new type of course that is becoming possible and becoming popular in on the internet today. And we're calling it a cohort-based course, or a CBC. So what is a cohort-based course? A cohort-based course is a course where a group of people agree to join this course and start at the same time, and then complete the course together through guided activities and workshops and peer review and peer learning, and then complete the course at the same time. So it has a defined start and end date. The power of that is that it has the same power of education as we've been educating people for centuries or millennia, which is that in any classroom in college or any class, you know, in high school or whatever, you take a course with a group of students, and there are a bunch of things that you do with those students that help you learn. And somehow through video-based courses and MOOCs, we had lost the community element to education. Mm-hmm. And so what this business does or will do is we are going to offer people who want to teach cohort-based courses with an ability to do that easily, so that they can simply click a button and it's as easy as, for example, launching a Substack or creating a website in Webflow or something like that.
Like if we're looking at a macro level education, and again, this is someone speaking as a complete novice, I don't know much about it, but I'm just saying from my own experience, we've got the traditional school system, high school, college, etc. Then you've got like extracurricular kind of courses people pay for themselves. Sometimes they're at universities, but often they're at places like General Assembly is a place I've taught at, and other, you know, schools like that. There's coding schools. And then you've got this kind of MOOC world online, and then you've got the kind of like, what would you count masterclasses in as part of the MOOC world, or is that their own kind of category?
Yeah, I think they're part of the MOOC
they're
world.
They're part of the MOOC world. On the online space, we've got the MOOCs, and then we've got now these cohort-based. Are there other segments that I'm not thinking of, or are those the two big kind of types of courses people are doing right nowadays?
I think the third category is boot camps.
Okay.
So it's boot camps are essentially fully baked online schools. So they're not, they're sort of, if MOOCs are just videos that you pay to have access to, and cohort-based courses are target the same market or maybe a slightly more advanced student, but they target that student and provide them with a far more immersive and hopefully a more rich experience, then boot camps are full-service schools. They function and offer the same value as a technical degree or a university. They just do it outside of the traditional accreditation system.
So would like Lambda School be a boot camp or?
Exactly. Lambda School, App Academy, Thinkful. These are all boot camp providers.
Great. And you kind of leave with a tangible skill. A lot of the time it might be like a technical skill or something like that. And one other thing to call out is the price difference, right? Because again, an on-demand course on Udemy, you might pay like $50 for or something like that. But a lot of these courses that are cohort-based are, first of all, limited number of people can normally join because there's like an instructor who's actually there, maybe David Perel in your writing course. He can't have 10,000 people on the call, right? He can only have a few, a limited amount. So the cost is normally like in the thousands, it seems like. So is that like the target price range that you guys are looking at?
Yeah. So the price range that I expect courses to be in, we'll see because it's early and we're still figuring it out, to be somewhere between, you know, $500 on the low end to a few thousand dollars on the higher end. There will also be people who offer courses that are free or much cheaper than $500. And there will be people who offer courses that are much more expensive than a few thousand dollars. The idea of a format is that the format is agnostic in some ways to the price and agnostic to what you're trying to learn. So, you know, video-based courses there are $5,000 video-based courses. And there are also courses that are $10. Cohort-based courses will probably trend to have a higher average, but they will also be anywhere from free. I'm sure there will be people who use our platform and offer courses completely for free. And then there will be people who use our platform and offer courses that are $15,000 and are a little bit more like if you're a coach, you are sort of doing coaching at scale, right? So you're doing coaching for 10 people instead of one at a time. And that's an example of the higher end of this. And then the lower end of this is, hey, I'm going to do a 2-day course that's that's a intro course might be $250 or $500. So we'll see what people decide to price it at, and we don't know for sure, but that's sort of the rough range.
Let's talk a little bit about like the size of the opportunity, because I'm curious how big you think this can be, and like, will this in like a 10-year range, do you feel like these sorts of courses online will replace, you know, traditional schooling, or is it always just something on top of the traditional system we've already got?
Eventually, I do hope that these replace traditional schooling, or at least offer a meaningful alternative to probably like late high school and college. And then for now, our vision is to focus, or our efforts are all focused on getting the casual and professional education markets to utilize these courses. I think eventually, you know, if you come on our platform today and you decide to join us on this mission of providing a better education and providing an education online that's better than what's in person, you should expect that over time we will offer you with more and more ways to help improve that education system. And so I expect that eventually we will offer degrees and offer our instructors the ability to help students leverage cohort-based courses as an alternative to graduate school or college. I don't necessarily know that, you know, we're going to destroy or disrupt or whatever these other institutions, but we will offer a meaningful alternative that I think will make a big difference in this world and hopefully help a lot of people learn in new and more interesting ways and have access to better quality instruction while doing it.
Looking at this space, it's really an emerging space, and I've been seeing people like David Perel, who you mentioned earlier. Tiago Forte is another guy who has a course about building a second brain. Ali Abdal, who's one of my favorite YouTubers right now, he's just done a YouTuber Academy with a similar sort of style of course. Are there like best-in-class examples you guys are looking at to either partner with and bring them onto your platform, or just looking to for inspiration?
Yeah, the ones you named are great examples. I mean, David is an investor in the company and a friend now. He lives in Austin as well, so we get a chance to see each other every once in a while. And I think that what they built at Rite of Passage is incredible. Other examples are Reforge, OnDeck, AltMBA, Section 4. These are all inspirations for us. Wes or I have actually worked with or know people at each of these companies, which is nice. So we have some real experience, and Wes has helped build a lot of these. I mean, she created the AltMBA. She was there before Section 4 became Section 4. And so we have learned from and are going to help our future instructors learn from all of the best in class resources that are out there and provide technology and advice essentially that will help instructors build courses that are hopefully even better than what we already have out there from a cohort-based course perspective.
And so the last part of this is really about opportunities. So if someone's listening to this and they're an entrepreneur or they are interested in this space, I'd love to get your take on how they can build on top of what you're building. So I would probably split that into two parts. One is obviously course creators. So if that's someone who has something to share and expertise, that's one angle, obviously. So I'd love to dig into that in a second. And then the second part are, you know, people who are going to build services or partnerships that may supplement what you're already doing that you guys just don't have the time or room to focus on. So maybe we start with the types of courses that you think work best in this format. And are there like prerequisites? Should this be people who already have some sort of audience, or is it just anyone who has real expertise to share?
Because this is a format, there is a wide diversity of what is possible. And so rather than be prescriptive on a specific level, so this type of course or that type of course, you know, this subject or that subject, or you have this following or not, I'll say anyone who has an expertise and is naturally predisposed to share that with others in a structured and valuable way, is essentially someone who's a good teacher, has the potential to build a cohort-based course, and we will help them do that through software and through advice and through providing a best-in-class example. And so we believe that if you're an entrepreneur out there and you want to, you have a following and you want to monetize it, or you have knowledge and you want to monetize it, and you also want to share your knowledge with others, and you have a deep passion for helping people deal with the challenges that you dealt with to get to the point that you're at, you can probably be successful teaching online courses. Anyone who is a good instructor can teach an online course, a cohort-based course. So if you feel you could be a good instructor and you have a passion for learning and for outcomes for the people you teach, then check us out.
And then last part on that was just around building on top of the platform. And this might just be something we're too early in the process to know yet. But normally with any sort of shift in the way people are doing things, there's normally kind of the people that plug in. So as an example, Shopify came around and built the platform. Well, there were e-commerce platforms before, but they built a specific way of doing it. And then people built Shopify apps on top of that. Same thing with the iPhone. So I'm curious, like looking at your business, do you feel like there's going to be components or like software that needs to be built or processes that need to be figured out that people could start thinking about?
We have a couple ideas, but probably the best ideas are going to come from people out there who are, product visionaries are going to come up with ideas that we've never thought of. So we're certainly open to that too. I'm really excited about new platforms that are making live education better. Ideally, I think built on top of infrastructure that's as stable as Zoom. And so I think that there's a lot of room for improvement on live instruction. There's improvement on pedagogy. So how do you create courses that really help people learn, and how do you get interactive elements in those courses amongst students where they are likely to enjoy the experience and also learn more as a result of that? There are probably product innovations on everything that's, from a detail perspective, from course directories, right? How do you know who else is in your course? To how do we match you well with people in your course? To how do we ensure that you have a thriving community? And so there are lots of options. I don't know yet what's going to end up being the killer feature here. We're still at the earlier stages. We know how to build great cohort-based courses, and I think if you come and talk to us, we'll help you with that. But we don't know all of the technology and product features that are eventually going to be the most valuable to users and instructors. We're still going to figure that out over time.
Those were great examples already. So definitely a space to watch. Listen, man, I've taken up so much of your time and you've shared your whole story today. And this has been as in-depth as I've ever heard you share. So I really appreciate you taking so much time. And I know there's so much that people are going to learn from this. So I really appreciate you making time. Is there anywhere we should be sending people?
Yeah, we also have a Notion doc where we've been talking about the company and updating it. And there's an email list that has a few thousand people on it now, or maybe 1,500 people or so. So feel free to go there. And if you want to get updates from us, just sign up there.
Awesome, man. Well, listen, brother, I appreciate this. I'd love to do this again and see how the progress is going in 6-12 months or whatever. And I'm sure we've got a lot more to do together as well. So appreciate you taking time.
Well, thank you, Bilal. Thanks for the hard work you put into preparing for this. It was obvious in the questions and the depth of knowledge you had. So thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. I'll have an episode for you every week. These are raw, uncut, and actionable conversations with the greatest business minds and creators in the world. So make sure you're subscribed. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidi, BZAIDI, or CreatorLabFM on any other channel. I really appreciate it. It helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.